Good evening, good morning. Thank you for joining me tonight on Coast to Coast AM. I am your host, Dave Schrader. And if you're intrigued by all aspects of the strange and the supernatural, then you can join me Monday through Friday, 9 p.m. till midnight central on Darkness Radio as we explore monsters, myths, legends, conspiracies, and more. Check out darknessradio.com for updates and information. And I also invite you to join us in our live chat room right now. You can find it right on the front page of darknessradio.com. We will try to incorporate your questions and be a part of the live show this evening. Patricia Pearson joins us for the next 3 hours. She's a critically acclaimed journalist whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, among other publications. Her 5 books have been published in several countries, and she was a 2003 finalist for the Leacock Memorial Medal of Humor for her best-selling comic novel, Playing House, which was later adapted for television. This has little to do with the fact that Pearson's serious reporting and commentary appears regularly on matters ranging from wildlife conservation to mental health to murder in media spanning the New York Times to NPR, nor that she recently oversaw the research for a History Channel documentary on the science of the soul and has written a book about what people experience when they die. The documentary version of her book, A Brief History of Anxiety, Yours and Mine, aired on CBC in 2012 and recently won a Rocky Award from the Banff Global Television Festival. She has also won 3 National Magazine Awards and the Arthur Ellis Award for Best Nonfiction Book of 1998. Opening Heaven's Door, Investigating Stories of Life, Death, and What Comes After is the name of her new book. People everywhere carry with them extraordinary, deeply comforting experiences that arrived at the moment when they needed the most relief, when they lost a loved one. These experiences can include clear messages from beyond, profound and vividly beautiful visions, mysterious connections, and spiritual awareness. Foreknowledge of a loved one's passing, all of which evade explanation by science and logic. Most people keep these transcendent experiences secret. Deathbed experiences, nearing death awareness, and shared death experiences. Individuals and families guard them for fear they'll be discounted by hyper-rational scrutiny. Yet these very common occurrences have the power to console, comfort, and even transform our understanding of life and death. We've got all that coming up with our guest, Patricia Pearson, and her book, Opening Heaven's Door, Investigating Stories of Life, Death, and What Comes After, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader. Opening Heaven's Door, Investigating Stories of Life, Death, and What Comes After. Our guest, Patricia Pearson, is with us now. Good evening, Patricia. Thank you very much for spending some time with us.
Hello.
Well, I guess for you, it's good morning, huh? Pretty late for you already.
A little tiny bit, yes. I'm in Toronto.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. How did you get attracted to this topic? I mean, it seems like you've written a myriad of different articles throughout time and history, but what specifically about this drew your attention?
Well, it actually had to do with something that happened very personally to me and my family. So in 2008, in fact, the day my last book came out on anxiety, my father died, and it was very unexpected, and he died in the middle of the night. He wasn't ailing, and my sister was awake in her bedroom in Montreal, and she suddenly became aware of a presence in her bedroom, which had never happened to her before. This was completely, you know, a unique experience, and she felt hands on the back of her head, very gently, tenderly cupping the back of her head, and then she felt suffused with a sense of incredible contentment and sort of joy, and almost like there was a kind of, you know, an influx of some sort of energy. And at the time, she was like, wow, what's going on? I mean, this is really strange. And she was sort of kept in aloft in that feeling of joy and healing for a couple of hours. And then she got up and she told my nephew about it. She was so amazed. And then found out that my father had died. And then she herself died 9 weeks later from inflammatory breast cancer. And so that whole time frame and the experiences that my family and I witnessed, starting with that and then leading into some things we watched with Catherine in the hospice, just blew me away and completely changed my understanding of life and death, and I had to investigate.
Do you think because of her position and nearing death, that is why she became the main focal point for that visitation?
Yeah, I mean, at the time I didn't understand that, but now I do think that, because what we, you know, what the research shows is that people have visions of deceased relatives when they themselves are dying. So the closer they get to their own departure, they begin to see and or sense the presence of those that have gone before them. So, yeah, because I remember at the time my mother was like, well, you know, I was lying in bed right beside him. You know, why didn't I have any sense of his departure? But, of course, she wouldn't have been the one that would have necessarily been receptive to that, whereas Catherine was. Yeah.
Do you find in the research that you've done and the people you've spoken to, case studies, it, you know, I'm constantly asked, why wasn't I contacted after my loved one died? Why did my brother get contacted? Why did my mother get contacted? Why did my daughter get contacted, but not me? And I'm just curious, have you found that in cases where, you know, somebody in your family gets visited, you don't, perhaps your mother didn't feel what had gone on, but your sister did. Was there unresolved issues between your father and sister that maybe there wasn't between your mother and father? Do you find that there's those kind of links that transcend through these stories as well?
No, not in terms of unresolved issues, but I have noticed a couple of patterns. One is there was a lot of really interesting research done on who comes to who in the aftermath of or in the moment of death. And actually, the most common is for a parent to go to a child. So that seems to be, it's almost like the parental impulse extending past death. And it's most important to them to sort of reach out and reassure. And that's sort of been statistically found. And the other factor is, I think that there may be, you know, there's sort of hereditary clusters around things like, you know, propensity for musicality or anxiety and depression or, you know, mathematical genius or whatever that runs through different family lines. And it seems to me that there, when you look at some of this stuff, you begin to see patterns in families. So it's almost as if people have inherited an ability to pick up on subtle energy in certain families and not in others. So, you know, all of this stuff is still fairly uncertain, but I'm beginning to see those kinds of patterns in it.
And I apologize. Was this with your father? Was it sudden and unexpected?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that he died of a broken heart because he had just found out a few weeks earlier that Catherine's cancer had become terminal.
So he was very close to her then as well.
Oh, yeah,
I mean, this
totally
was something that he found that out and then, you know, in a parental way, I'm a father of seven myself. And if I knew that one of my children was going and might be frightened of the situation, I, as strange as it sounds, I could see wanting that release so that I could be there to help her or him
to
make that transition. And I know that probably sounds strange to a lot of people out there, but the idea of one of my children leaving before me is beyond comprehensible. So it's very interesting that you say that you believe that he died of a broken heart and that led him to that place. Had he spoken about, have you looked back now at the weeks leading up to his death, was he having visions or perhaps any foreshadowing that his time was nearing as well?
I don't know. That's a good question because I wasn't in the same city as him, so I wasn't having conversations with him about it. And he was, you know, he was 80. He was that generation of man who didn't really want to talk about their emotions or disclose what they were feeling. The one thing he did do, which was very unusual for him, was that he phoned my sister the week before he died and told her that he loved her. And in our family, not for me with my kids, but in that generation, actually saying those words out loud was pretty much never. So he was showing that he was reaching out to her before he died. And then it was like this situation where the whole family, although we'd never come across this ourselves at all, it instantly made complete sense to us that he was putting himself on the other side of where she was going so that he would be there for her when she got there. And then when she was in the hospice, she was looking up at the ceiling and she was having this kind of almost kind of coy sort of fun kind of teasing conversation with somebody that we couldn't see. And that was exactly the kind of expression that Catherine would have on her face when she was talking with my father. So, you know, I can't conclude what she was doing when she was talking to an invisible person, but it seemed very, very similar to how she talked to Dad. So that was really fascinating.
As a journalist, having this deep of an impact in your own personal life, was it hard to remain objective as you were doing the research for this? And you know, I know a lot of people that have tried to tackle this topic and they want to stay on the outside and look at the scientific principles of what could be going on. And we know that as people are nearing death and the brain is shutting down and the functions are shutting down, that memory synapses and oxygen deprivation and blood restriction could be firing off memories or firing off what appears to be somebody standing there in front of them when it's really nothing more than just a waking dream that they're having at that moment. Did you have a hard time rectifying between the science and the spirituality of this?
No, because I think what happened was my curiosity became, okay, science, you claim this, or scientists, you know, get quoted as claiming this, that, and the other thing about what happens around death. So what is the research on this? What does this show? What do we know about neuroscience and hallucination? What do we know about the impact of oxygen deprivation on people's perceptions? So I started pushing back against more or less assumptions that we kind of have about, oh, this is all explained away. And really, I was doing it in a way in defense of my sister. So it was a way of saying, you know, she was a smart, discerning woman, you know, who wasn't prone to a lot of imaginary, whatever you want to call it, or sentiment. If she had this powerful experience, particularly the night my father died, then the onus is on you to explain it to me, but it has to be real scientific evidence. It can't just be an assumption that this is going to be explained by the brain. So by going at it that way, that's when I discovered, you know, how little is actually known. So we tend to toss around these explanations, but they're really just scientific theories. They're not based on a lot of evidence.
I always found that very strange. When you have repeatable experiences, that's what science wants. They want to be able to say, we can repeat this and we can cull this information. And these experiences are being shared not in one religion, not in one ethnicity, not in one sexual preference, but around the world. And yet science still wants to take the position that, oh, there's nothing real about what's going on. This is just the brain shutting down. When there's no way for them to physically prove that that is what's going on. And I know there's going to be people say, well, of course they can prove that. But
no,
I don't know
can.
Many people that are hooked up to the wires at that moment of death or when those hallucinations are occurring that they can say this is truthfully the brain shutting down and dying. It is, like you said, hypothesis.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, and when you look at it from the point of view of sensed presence experiences, so between 45% and 55% of the bereaved population, not only in the United States, but around the world, like half the bereaved population has an experience of what's called anomalous cognition around death. So that's half the population that's having these experiences. The problem is that you can't, you know, there's no way that you can control that in a laboratory. You can't put that person in the lab and wait 4 years for them to suddenly sense the presence of somebody beside them in their bed, you know? So because science can't sort of get its hands around it, it just decides essentially to either offer theories about it or dismiss it outright. And that's, you know, the quandary that we're all in. And so we're made to feel like we're making things up, when in fact these are some of the most real and powerful and extraordinary and sacred experiences of people's lives.
And I'm really intrigued when you hear these stories and these shared experiences. And I don't know how much people realize that in situations like hospice or hospitals, when somebody's getting ready to cross, there are these shared experiences with the living people in the rooms or around the dying that pick up on what the other person is seeing. Some of them do share the visions of somebody coming into the room. Nurses, doctors, janitorial staff, aides have talked about seeing somebody walk into the room and then hearing the alarm go off that the person has gone into cardiac arrest, and when they walk in the room, there's nobody there, and the person has passed away. So there are these amazing stories of recollection, and shared by many different people instead of just the one that's dying or having the quote-unquote brain shutdown.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, it doesn't really have to do with the physiological process of the dying brain. There's also some really interesting things that go on with the dying that have to do with the way they try to express themselves as they begin to depart. So they begin to talk in metaphors of journey. They might request their passport and ticket, or they might say, I don't know how to leave. How am I supposed to leave? Or where's the boat? Or get my shoes. Or one hospice nurse told me about a patient who said, Monique, I need to go shopping. And she knew what she meant. So she said, well, when do you want to go shopping? And the woman said, well, we have to go on Monday. And she said, okay, we'll go shopping on Monday. And Monday was when she died. So hospice nurses actually begin to use that kind of language as a gauge for when their patients are going to go. Sorry, I've got like a frog in my throat.
Well, when
what
we...
must happen at 2 in the morning?
Yeah, exactly. That'll get you in the middle of the night here. When you start talking to these people in hospice and the workers, which to me, that's one of the hardest jobs. I couldn't imagine being there to help somebody transition to the ending. Do they see that in that last few moments, do people have a sense of relief, or do most go in a sense of fear? You know, are they being assisted as they cross over?
No, they are being assisted. There is a tremendous sense that when people are in clear consciousness in the hour before death, and that's not a lot of people. Most people are in coma at that point. But there's a huge cross-national study in India and the United States that shows in that hour of death, of dying, the majority of people have an elation. Their mood shifts to elation. They may gesture towards something you can't see. They may see somebody that you can't see and say, oh, look, you know, there's Russell or whatever. Or in some cases, actually, they have what's called cases of terminal lucidity, where somebody who's had Alzheimer's for 3 years will come clear in the hour before death or in the 24 hours before death. Or they'll be able to they'll regain mobility in their limbs if they've been paralyzed. So there's this kind of breaking free of the kind of material bonds and the bonds of the brain that's going on. And, you know, it's an amazing thing to witness, I'm sure, for many hospice staff who repeatedly tell me that they see these things. Not everybody has it. It can depend on your disease process. It can depend on your level of sedation. If you're too sedated, then you're not going to have these visions. So, in fact, it's not the medication that's causing them. The medication can get in the way of them sometimes.
A very strange situation had arisen a number of years, I guess about 10, 12 years ago, when my friend's stepfather had slipped into a coma, and it was just a waiting game. They knew that his time of passing was near, and there was nothing they could do, and he wasn't regaining consciousness. And I'd called the hospital to try to catch up with everybody else and see what was going on. And lo and behold, he had woken up earlier when my friend's wife called the room. The ringing the phone woke him from the coma. He sat up, had everybody come together. They had dinner together that night at the hospital. He got to watch Bonanza, his favorite show. There was this chance for everybody to give hugs and kisses. And as cleanly and swiftly as he came out of this coma, he went right back into it and passed away within hours. But there was this moment of clarity as though he felt he had to come back to say his goodbyes and give the chance for some closure for those that were staying on this side. We're going to talk about more cases like that, about cases of shared near-death experiences, what happens to us when we approach death, life, death, and what comes after. Patricia Pearson is our guest this evening, talking about opening heaven's door right on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to the show. This evening, our guest, Patricia Pearson, opening heaven's door, investigating stories of life, death, and what comes after. Patricia, with the research that you've done for the book and the case studies and the research that goes on, are there any connections that you can find with people that expire, hospitals, hospices, things like that, where it seems that many will go in a circuit at the same time? Does death seem to follow a certain curve at these type of locations?
No, I don't think so. I think that the dying are able to hold off on their own demise, depending on whether family members are there, or sometimes they don't want them to be there. So it seems to have much more to do with the dynamic of, you know, within families. So waiting for somebody to fly home from Europe or something like that. Somehow they're able to control their own kind of the physical process of dying to some extent so that they can hit a milestone or greet somebody that really needs to be there. So you see that more than certainly, at least in terms of research I've done. Have you found something different?
But no, I just, like I said, you know, my mother's a nurse, and we have many of our friends and family that have worked in elderly care homes and hospice. And you know, it does seem that little pocket bubbles will pop up from time to time where it's almost as though they're collecting all at the same time. And sometimes people will witness their friends that have passed in the last day or two seeming to be in the room there to help collect them when the time is ready to go.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. And that's actually called a Pekindarian experience. I don't know why, but it is. And sometimes you'll have that where you'll have people who've, like a family that's been in a collective car accident, but they don't know that, you know, the state of one another in the hospital. And one of them will be wondering why they see their sister. And it turns out that the sister would have already died, you know, just before they die, that kind of thing. So the very first deathbed vision in modern times that was recorded was in 1924 in Dublin, Ireland. And the woman was dying in childbirth. And the obstetrician, and there were a number of witnesses actually in the room, and she started to talk about how beautiful what she was witnessing was. And then she said, oh, there's my father. And then she said, and Vita is with him. Why is Vita with him? And Vita was her sister who had died a couple of weeks earlier, but they'd kept it from her because her pregnancy was complicated. So, yeah, that's called a sort of Pekindarian experience.
Very intriguing. We'll continue our journey and learn more about the research in the book, Opening Heaven's Door. Patricia Pearson, our guest. When we return, I'd like to find out, we always hear of these wonderful stories of people being greeted by loved ones, by the light, the voices of angels calling them forward. Are there cases where things don't go that way? And it seems that something negative has come to collect. We'll find out what Patricia knows about that right after this.
Geico presents a man who just saved on his motorcycle insurance.
First off, my name is Daryl. Second, this is no motorcycle. This monster is 1,100 cc's of raw internal combustion power.
Feel the ground shake!
Now, I know what you're thinking. Where's this science teacher's logical attitude that goes with his sensible sneakers? Well, Mr. Rains on my parade, I saved a bunch on motorcycle insurance with Geico. Now, if you'll excuse me, I've got some young minds that need molding.
Geico Motorcycle. See how much you could save.
Hi, Tom Baudet. Well, what's the big deal with zombies? Seems every day there's some new show about groaning, shuffling, half-dead people. Sounds a lot like business travelers. Well, use your brains, folks, before they're eaten, and check into Motel 6 for a clean, comfortable room at a great low rate. You'll sleep much better knowing that we'll leave the light on for you, because that'll scare the zombies away. Or maybe attract them. You know what? Never mind about the light. Book online at motel6.com.
Are you one of the 100 million Americans living with pain? Joint pain, muscle aches, back pain? Would you like an all-natural pain reliever that works in just 1 hour? Well, it's finally here. It's called 1 Hour Pain Relief. It's made from hops, the same plant used to flavor beer. It goes to work fast without dangerous side effects. I'm Barry Yarkoni, company president. I had lingering pain from a nasty fall, but was scared of the side effects of drugs. Now I get relief in just 1 hour that lasts for the whole day. We're so sure you'll love 1 hour pain relief too that we'll send you a 1 week trial for just a small shipping charge. Call 800-500-1810 right now or visit onehourpainrelief.com. There's no gimmicks, no obligation, no automatic shipments. Stop living with pain. Call 800-500-1810 or visit onehourpainrelief.com. That's 800-500-1810 or onehourpainrelief.com.
Patricia Pearson is the author of the new book, Opening Heaven's Door, investigating stories of life, death, and what comes after. You know, Patricia, I got the life part down. I'm not looking forward to the death, but what scares the hell out of me is what comes after. And we hear all of these stories on TV and movies and magazine articles and books about these heavenly moments when we're no longer alone and something seems to be there lovingly to greet us and help us through the light, the voices of angels, light surrounding us, angelic figures. Does it ever go the opposite way? Do you hear many stories where it turns into a hellish moment for the person that's about to pass?
Well, there's two different ways to look at that, because one of them has to do with what happens in a deep near-death experience. And in that case, I've talked to people who what they actually experience is that they are made to or they wind up reliving their life, their actions in their life from the point of view of the people that they had an effect on. So they experience the emotional impact of their actions. And depending on what they did in their lives, that can be essentially a hellish experience because, I mean, if you imagine it from the point of view of Hitler and the impact that he had on all of those lives and then reliving that from their point of view rather than his point of view, that's what people that I've interviewed who've had near-death experiences will describe. So both the positive and the negative in their own lives from the point of view of other people, but sort of outside time. So which they find really hard to explain, but it's not like it sort of lasts for an eternity. It's sort of it somehow happens outside of, you know, linear time. But I know one guy I talked to, he said now he's terrified to even harm a fly because he went through that experience of what it was like. So it's different than, you know, the idea of scary monsters. It's more about you and how love reverberates and how your anger and hate might reverberate through space and time, which I find fascinating, actually. It's almost like thinking of hell as a kind of emotional state rather than, you know, with demons and forks and whatever. And then in terms of deathbed visions, when I interview hospice staff, they'll say that these are mostly love stories, not ghost stories. But sometimes people will have disease process related hallucinations that'll make them very anxious and agitated. And so, you know, they might see things that they find very frightening, but hospice staff will say that has a different feel to it than when they see like deceased relatives. It's almost more of a kind of random and agitating thing that when the hallucination fades, then they calm down. Whereas when they see takeaway visions, it changes them. It changes their emotional response to what's about to happen. So it's complicated and it's subtle. And I think there's a lot of research that still needs to be done. But
where do you stand now, Patricia, from before writing this book to now? Has it had a profound change in the way you look at religion and death?
Yeah, for sure. Because I think it makes me realize that, you know, personally, based on interviewing various people and doing a lot of reading and research, I think that all religions essentially are of the same God. And that, you know, what we experience is a kind of reunion with that sort of loving divine force. And almost people will describe it to me as kind of merging into a sea of love and light, finding their way home after centuries. Very much there's a sense of kind of returning home. So it's a very, there doesn't seem to be any kind of doctrine around it. In these experiences, it's all much more, about the importance of love and compassion as a way to live your life. So that's, you know, for me, I'd never really thought about it, I suppose, before. I mean, I'm a Christian in my background, but kind of the, you know, the one that goes, you know, for Christmas.
So a C&E Christian, sure.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I get emails after shows like this. A lot of really angry mail that comes out to the point of, hey, Dave, it's 2014. How can you still believe in a God and and believe in these things and believe that there's a heaven? There's nothing. This is it. And I'll have people quote me science and that science has said this and science has said that and that there is no God, there is no heaven, there is no hell, that when we cease to exist here, we just cease to exist. Yet again, there's that case where it seems there's so many different claims that would have us look at it a different way. But what does science really tell us about religion and death and dying? Do they have a hard-edged approach, or is it a lot of people throwing statistics around that don't really even exist?
I think there's a lot of theories that are coming out of assumptions. So it depends. And, you know, there are a lot of scientists who are agnostic about these issues, and they don't take a stand. There's an increasing number of scientists, actually, in the States who have a respect for the spiritual universe. And you know, a lot of the research that I'm looking at in my book comes from, you know, really, really meticulous scientists who, you know, aren't devoting themselves to just debunking all of this, but rather, you know, what is it like to have a trance experience, a mystical experience versus imagination or memory? You know, how can we fMRI image the difference? And they have, in fact, done that. They've been able to show that there's a difference in the way the brain looks between a Carmelite nun in prayer and somebody who's just dreaming or imagining. So, you know, there's a lot of very dedicated people kind of playing around the edges of what it means to live in a religious world, or, you know, a spiritual universe, I guess is the way to put it. And then, you know, but the louder voices are the ones that have just decided on a faith basis that there's no God.
When people are relating their experiences, you brought up a very nice way of saying, you know, that it's more about a feeling of love and a sense of just this, there is no God, there's no Buddha, there's no, you know, Elvis, there's whatever it is. It's just this feeling of love. And when my grandfather passed away, for me, it was very, very tough. He was my hero. He was my father figure in my life. And after he passed, he came to me in a dream visitation.
Oh, yeah.
And I asked him specifically, I said, you know, were your parents there to greet you? And he said, sure. And he said, my brothers and sisters that went before me and your grandmother was here. And then I remember having this conscious thought and I thought, oh my God, grandma was there. And then I said, what is going to happen when Noelle, your second wife, dies? And he looked at me and he said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, if you're with grandma, what's going to happen when Noelle dies? And he started with this great laughter, and he said, that's a great question. And he goes, well, we'll all be here to meet him or meet her. And then I thought, well, what kind of kinky place is heaven? You're going to be living with both of them? And he said, let me explain to you. He goes, where we are, there is no ownership. There is no title. I don't, you know, you're not my girlfriend, my wife, my this, my, it's love. We just become a part of this love. And they'll be here, and her husbands that preceded her in death will be here. And it was at that point that I had related that story back to my mom and aunt a few days later. And I had no idea that my step-grandmother had been married two other times, and both of them died before she married my grandfather.
Oh, yeah.
So here I was given information that I did not know, or right. I guess, you know, I guess the skeptical side could say maybe I heard it growing up and it just didn't process, and this was a reminder. But that whole universal feel of love really was what his message was to me as well. So I find it fascinating that with the research you've done on this, that's very much the same findings.
Yeah, for sure. And it's so interesting to listen to people talk about it, because they will, you know, it's a powerful, powerful experience. It's not some sort of, you know, kind of drifting, kind of daydreamy idea of love. It's like, you know, I interviewed one woman who's a doctor who was in a plane crash, and she merged into, you know, this light that was also love, that was also wisdom, that was also like her, she felt like a baby on her mother's shoulder. You know, she felt so unconditionally loved. And it's very, very, very difficult for people to talk about, because it's the experience is not comparable to any other emotional experience that we have. People will describe it as 1,000 times more powerful or 1,000 times more real than this reality when they merge into that light and that love. And, you know, so that they're kind of at a disadvantage because they can't really explain it to you. And, you know, it's the problem of what's called ineffability, that it's ineffable, it's impossible to describe. It would be like trying to explain snow to, you know, somebody, you know, in the center of Africa who'd never traveled outside of their village. Or it's that kind of impossible experience to really convey to other people. And that, I think, is where the skeptics get to rush in, because how do you argue with them? Because you can't even explain to them what you've experienced.
I'm always fascinated by the way people share their experiences and talk about near-death experiences, shared death experiences, and the like. And we'll open up phone lines in the fourth hour tonight to allow you to call in with questions for our guest, Patricia Pearson, and to share your real-life encounters with near-death experiences, with those shared death experiences as well. People share like I mentioned, mine was what's referred to as a dream visitation. And I can't explain the situation. It's so easy to discount it from the outside as nothing more than a dream and a wish of the brain and heart wanting to have that moment with my grandfather again. But I can also tell you that that dream, that visitation, is more clear to me than most of my actual memories that I have of my grandfather. It was so clear, concise, and vivid, down to the smells, the sounds, the sights that I had. How does that rectify with your understanding and research as well? Why does that dreamlike state seem to be so much more memorable than the reality of communication?
I don't know. I mean, there was a study that was done a couple of years ago where they took people and they compared people's memories of a near-death experience, people's memories of childhood experience, and people's memories of an experience around being in a dramatic accident or something. And what they found was that the near-death experiences were by far and away the most powerful memories that any of these people had had. So it didn't have to do with the importance. It wasn't memorable because it was around death per se, because the people who had the dramatic experiences without the NDE didn't have the same strength of memory. So, but they talk in the research about what are called flashbulb memories, which is when you have a more vivid memory of a really important and profound and novel experience than you would of something else. So your first kiss or your first experience of a spring snowfall or, you know, whatever. So in your case, that would have been the first time in your life that you'd had that kind of dream. And so it would have that kind of intense sort of flavor of vividness for the rest of your life. I'm sure that if my sister had lived that night that my father seemed to be in her bedroom, would be one of her, probably, you know, her most powerful and vivid and clear memory. So it's that interplay between what's so new and to you, and then also some kind of a spiritual force in it that makes it so memorable, I think.
Do you believe that that is a real experience that might have happened with a spiritual element to it, though? Or do you believe that it is just the brain firing off and trying to deal with grief?
No, I think it's a real experience. I don't know what it means, but I think it's a real experience. Absolutely. Because these things happen there's many, many times where when somebody, they'll have, like, for instance, I talked to a woman who woke up in the middle of the night thinking that her window had shattered in her bedroom. And it was so vivid that she jumped out of bed, adrenaline rushing, and went to find the shards of glass on her bed. And then there was nothing there, and she was completely baffled. And the next day she found out that her daughter had gone through the windshield of a car at that moment. So many times these experiences happen before you have any reason to assume that someone has died or been in distress. So there's no way to explain that in traditional psychological terms. It just doesn't work.
When we return after the top of the hour, we'll continue to talk about some of the cases and some of the stories that she shares and relates in her new book, Opening Heaven's Door, Investigating Stories of Life, Death, and What Comes After. Patricia Pearson is our guest this evening. And Patricia, is there a website people can go and share encounters and stories with you? Are you still collecting and
yeah, for sure. Doing a lot of work? A lot of people are posting their experiences to my website, which is PearsonsPost.com/WordPress, WP. So PearsonsPost.com/WP for, yeah, WordPress. And they're really, really interesting what people are sharing.
Fantastic. So you can check it out. We have a link for it up on our website as well at Coast to Coast AM. Just go check out coasttocoastam.com and find tonight's guest. You'll see links to her book, to her website, and find ways to communicate with her, share your real-life encounters. And we'll open up phone lines in the fourth hour so that you can share your encounters with us this evening. We've got a lot more coming your way. We've got a lot of great stories and some very intriguing insights to this whole phenomena coming up here on Coast to Coast AM. So I ask that you stay with us. Again, I'm your host for the evening. My name is Dave Schrader. I'll be sitting in with you, and I'll be back again hosting Coast to Coast on Friday, June 27th. We've got a great show we're lining up for you that night as well. Thank you very much for your love and support, for letting me host Coast to Coast AM. You can hit me up if you have questions for our guest at dave@darknessradio.com. That's dave@darknessradio.com. And we'll continue with more Coast to Coast AM right after this.